You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I know so many comedians who are unhappy. You know more than I do, but there's not a lot of happy stand-up comedians. Like,
no, although I'm happy. And
there you go.
You know, I've had...
Well, you're probably a shitty comedian. So
it's, you know, it's true. Yeah. But I guess I had 20 years of... adulthood where I was
successful.
No, miserable.
Oh.
A comedian or a humorist goes into a room and looks for what's wrong.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of really practice that over and over again, looking for what's wrong.
That is exactly what comedians are doing. Everybody wants the world to be rational. Everybody wants there to be an explanation for things.
And yet it's so irrational.
And it's completely irrational.
Yeah.
You can't make humor-impaired people suddenly have a sense of humor, and you can't make stupid people smart, and you can't make assholes not be assholes. You can't! So you either can, like, enjoy them or just ignore them. Those are your best two options. Confronting them is not a good option.
You can't make stupid people smart. I want to write that down. Because you're so right. That is true.
You just finding this out now?
Yes, I am, because I always want to make them smarter. No. So I have been hoping for this podcast for at least 3 or 4 years. I'm so happy to have maybe the best or probably the best humor writer in the country, Dave Barry. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Wow. Wow. Thank you.
No, but seriously, like, you know, I read, first off, we're doing this podcast in a stand-up comedy club that I own. I do stand-up comedy. I read a lot of books by comedians. And I always think the books by comedians are going to be funny, but they're usually more like memoirish, whatever. There's one author, I think, who is laugh out loud funny. Like, I read every page and I'm laughing out loud, and it's your books. It's very hard to read a book where you like laugh out loud, because usually, like, I could even picture like you making a Dave Barry like joke about this, like the purpose of a book is to keep your face absolutely frozen while everyone thinks you're intelligent and you actually then end up memorizing none of it. But when I read your books, I'm laughing. My face is moving.
Well, thank you. It's a different skill, I think. Stand up, I mean, you know, stand up is hard and it's, you know, it takes a lot of practice to be able to do it. Even if you think you're funny with your friends, it's really hard to get up in front of strangers and make them laugh. But you know, it's a different skill entirely from writing funny, where you don't have the tools that a comedian has. You don't have pauses. You don't have expression. You don't have emphasis. You don't have hand gestures. You don't have silence. You don't have any of those tools to use. It's just the words, and the reader gets to decide how exactly he or she reads them. So you have to learn a different discipline, I think, to be funny.
Well, the thing is, and by the way, we're here to talk about your most recent book, Lessons from Lucy, where, again, so Lucy is your dog. You were turning 70 when you started this book. You're 71 now. Lucy, also in dog years, is 70, is 10 years old. And you were learning all these important life lessons at the age of 70, which are great lessons. But again, I see this not as a book about your dog or a book about these life lessons, although they're important, but again, just another vehicle for you to be funny on each page. Like I love, and we're going to get into what you just said in a second, but I just want to mention, I love so many things, but like I was laughing out loud at your jokes about the AARP, getting older. So the AARP is the Association of Retired Professionals. And, you know, you go on and on, like
what, oh, they come. They I get a lot of. Do you get art mail yet?
How old do you think I am? But I should be.
Well, they start early, man. They start like when you're like now. I think when you're around 18, you start getting.
I think I am starting to see the ads on the internet. So I'm 51.
You're going to be bombarded, and you know they want you to do lots of things, but their premise is that it's okay. You really, age isn't just a number. It's, you're not really getting older. There's no limitations, you know, and it's, you know, not true.
Right. Well, so it's so funny because I think it is a stand-up style joke, the way you put it. Like, you know, they say, oh, life begins at 65. And you're like, nope, you have to retire as a pilot at 65.
Well, my joke in there is like, you know, you want to get on a plane, the captain says, well, we reached a comfortable cruising altitude. Oh, no, wait, we're still on a runway, you know? And you don't want your pilot to be 80. You don't.
I mean, right, or your brain
I'm
surgeon.
I'm old, and I don't want my pilot to be my age. You know, I'm right. 71. I want a younger-than-me person being the pilot of the plane. So there's a certain element of bullshit to the ARP philosophy.
But again, though, there's kind of like the premise, which is ARP is wrong and aging sucks. And then you have sort of a punchline in there, which is they say, you know, you can do anything at 65. Nope. An airline pilot has to retire at 65. So clearly they're wrong. And then there's an act out. You could pretend to be the pilot. And I mean, it's perfect.
You
say stand-up comedy.
I'm doing stand-up comedy in the book. Yeah. But, you know, I have learned over the years, because if you write, you also talk. You have to go to bookstores. You know, and if you're writing humor books, you want to be funny when you talk. And I've learned that a remarkable amount of stuff that works great on the page isn't necessarily going to be great in spoken humor. And sometimes stuff that is really funny when you say it really doesn't work that well on the page.
It's true, because on stand-up, cadence is also important, and your
critical
facial expressions and so on. You know, you could sometimes say something completely not funny on stage, but if your cadence is just right, if the tone of your voice is a little bit like not expected, then people will they're like trained to laugh at that cadence.
Yeah.
So that's one. But it's also hard. You still need the economy of words. Like you put it in one interview with, you had a really great podcast with Tyler Cohen, who's a friend of mine, where you still need that economy of words, and you need to put the funny stuff at the end. Like with a stand-up comic joke, the funniest word should be the last word.
Yeah, and this is a simple rule of comedy that I think everyone in theory knows, and in written humor anyway, people violate that rule all the time. I get these, you know, things people send me that, do you think this is funny? And it's either like one premise kind of overdone to a ridiculous degree, or there is a joke in there, but then there's like 38 words after the end of the joke.
Yeah.
And what, you know, that's like if you were a comic and people are laughing and you're still talking, you know, you just don't do that. You let them laugh.
Yeah, no, very true. And that's why I think the way you particularly write comedy, and I want to get into kind of the details of the book, but I'm also fascinated by the process of humor and comedy and writing. The way you do it has a very stand-up flavor. Like later on when you're saying your jokes about Facebook, I was again laughing out loud, like, you know, we've sort of, you know, trimmed away at emotions so that they're now just emojis.
You can have five emotions on Facebook.
Right. And
laugh, sad, love, like, or what, happy, or something like that. Yeah. These are your emotions on Facebook and you're confined to those.
Yeah. And language does actually, you know, create your internal emotions. So when you start limiting language to emojis, which is what a lot of kids do, that might be the only emotions our kids grow up with.
No, I sometimes find myself having a debate when I'm reading something on Facebook. Do I like that or do I love that? I don't really love that, but maybe I should put a heart there anyway, you know, to make that person feel better.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go through that kind of thinking when I'm just talking to people.
You know what I always think? When someone says, like, there's a lot of Facebook posts of happy posts, but there's also the sad one, like, you know, someone you vaguely know, they're grandmother passed away,
and you make a little sad face,
right? And so my gut instinct is to put the sad face, but then I'm thinking
it's not enough,
right? Like I should, if I really know the person, I should write a message. I'm sorry for your loss.
No, so, just put a sad face, like Holocaust sad face,
right? I was thinking once of someone I vaguely knew. I didn't really know. Said, oh, you know, my sweet booby, like she passed away. You know, 99 years old, and I was about to do the sad face, and I was thinking of saying, you know, that I can't do that. That's like so unemotional and impersonal. It's just like, it's like a joke. So I was thinking of just writing, you know, she deserved it. And because obviously it's a joke, and I'm showing that I'm not just going to put some blanket emoji.
Then you have to put a sarcasm face.
Right, that's right.
So they know.
Otherwise people get
mad. They get furious.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Right.
I mean, unless it's somebody who really gets you.
Well,
you don't care what anybody else thinks.
One of your lessons in this, and I don't think it's in the same chapter. One of your lessons is, you know, I'm going to misword it, but try not to be angry so much. You know, this is sort of a humor book posing to be a self-help book. So there's actual life lessons, but you know, don't be so angry so much. And every day I have this urge. I better respond to this anonymous stranger on Twitter who just said something bad about me that I need to correct.
Yeah.
Like, and I this morning I'm preparing for you and I'm like, oh, I'm just going to check my notifications about me, of course. And someone said something, you know,
wrong. Wrong.
Something wrong about me. Something actually inaccurate and wrong and insulting. And so I didn't want to tweet publicly, so I pulled up his page, hit message, and I was about to respond when I was like, didn't Dave Barry just say
let it go,
try to be angry less? So, and I'm not even an angry type of person. It's like if the internet wasn't created, I probably never would be angry, or maybe I'd find some other outlet.
There's a really great cartoon that sort of sums it all up, and it's a woman, and she's trying to get her husband to go to bed, and he's going, I can't go to bed now. Someone is wrong on the internet.
Yeah.
And it's like, and the internet is apparently designed to make us care about people we shouldn't care about and what they think. But you know, it's really hard, especially if you're in the public eye. I mean, I used to get, when I wrote a weekly humor con, I used to get the most ridiculous mail. I learned over the years to enjoy it, even the really angry people. But at first it, you know, it was like, I would write a column and say that, you know, a great sight to see in Paris is the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And it's a joke. And I would get so much mail from people, not just correcting me, but pompously correcting me about how the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you know, perhaps, I don't know how they decide who to hire to write your newspaper column, mister, but you should do a little research for, you know, like, and I used to, at first I would respond by saying, it's a humor column, idiot, don't you? Then I learned to get, you know, to sort of enjoy it. And I would write back and say, no, the Leaning Tower of Pisa was moved to Paris in 1993, you know, Just because you really can't change them. You can't make humor impaired people suddenly have a sense of humor, and you can't make stupid people smart, and you can't make assholes not be assholes. You can't. So you either can like enjoy them or just ignore them. But those are your best two options. Confronting them is not a good option.
You can't make stupid people smart. I want to write that down. Because you're so right. That is true.
You didn't know? You're just finding this out now?
Yes, I am. Because I always want to make them smarter. No.
Do you confront people? I mean, like in public. The example, I give in my book, that's something that just infuriates me. And I wrote about it, and I say, let go of your anger. And if it happened to me today, I'd still get furious. It's like you're in an ice cream line, and they give samples. You know, the kind of like a... instead of just a plain old ice cream store, now, of course, it has 93 flavors, and they all have cute names, and they give you a little spoon, and you can taste a little taste, you know, and it's okay. If nobody's in the store, I don't care how many you taste. But if I'm in a line behind you, and like there's 15 of us waiting, you cannot take, you know, one and then try it again and ask your friend to try it and then say, can I try that one again? You can't do that. It's, you know, it's wrong and you should be shot. Somebody should come in and shoot you, and no jury in the land would convict you if I'm on that jury. Okay, do you confront people in that? I never do. I just seethe and then maybe write about it later on.
See, I never do, but I don't necessarily seethe about that either. And so here's an interesting point about humor, and I got to remember this. There's a fork in the road here because it's something I want to get back to. But I don't really give a shit about most things. But this is what I'm wondering, and I wonder this from a comedic point of view and from a humorous point of view. Like, you know, you seethe about this, I don't, but this gives you content for something humorous. Right,
exactly.
So I have to dig a little differently for
humor.
Well,
how do you react if you're seeing that behavior and it's inconveniencing you? Granted, it's a minor inconvenience, but it's still, what do you do?
I don't
get mad?
You know, I don't really care. I get mad when somebody is wrong about me and is insulting me. But even then, I kind of try really hard to do what you did, like just to roll with it. Even though this morning I was like angry enough, I almost responded. But, you know, even when I'm angry, it's like someone writes to me something like crazy, like I should be shot or whatever, and I'll just respond with a question mark. And then they'll write back with like a whole explanation of why they're angry, and I'll respond with two question marks. And I try to see how many question marks I can go. I've gotten up to 5 question marks and finally said, I see what you're doing. Fuck you. And
well, okay,
and then
that's a very passive aggressive.
Yes.
So you're not seething, but you're still mad. You're mad enough to be hostile.
Yes.
You're
right.
Okay. That,
but the question about seething, you know, so I'm going to finish the intro with you, which is you've written something like 50 books. You know, one of your books was made into a movie, maybe more. A book was made into a hit Broadway show. You had a TV show based on your life, Dave's World, that ran for 4 years or 5 years. You had a syndicated column to 400 newspapers for what, like 20 years, 23 years, something like that. And you've had this huge, amazing career, basically the dream life, all about being funny and telling jokes. So I want to get back to the arc of your career in a second, but in terms of the seething leading, you know, the being angry, being inconvenienced, leading to humor, they say a lot of comedy comes from some, you know, dark place inside. And, you know, you've had a troubled early family life. You know, I don't know how much you talk about it, but, you know, dad, alcoholic, your mom, who you say was extremely funny but had a dark edge. She sadly ended up killing herself. You've had all sorts of troubles and some troubles even in your last book we'll talk about. But do you think that led to you this defense mechanism where you had to kind of deal with troubles with humor?
No.
Okay.
I get no.
Sorry.
Yes. No.
That's
I mean,
a huge question.
It's a really good question, and I get asked that. And so I've had a lot of time to think about it over the years. And everything you say is true. I just want to correct one thing about my dad. He was an alcoholic. My dad suffered from alcoholism. He was a really good man, and he got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he spent the rest of his life doing good. You know, he was a great guy and a pretty stable human being who had that problem and overcame it or dealt with it. Like alcoholics don't say they overcome it, but he recovered or whatever they say. And
he was sober.
Sober. And he was a great guy and, you know, is a good dad. And my mom did commit suicide, and she was an unhappy, she suffered from depression. She was also the funniest person I've ever met in my life. So those things were true. And yet, and maybe this is just some kind of denial on my part, my childhood was really happy. I mean, my dad's drinking didn't start till I was out of college, and it ended after a few years, and he was fine. My mom did have that issue, and we all dealt with it, but at the same time, I loved being around my mom. I mean, she was hilarious. I loved when I, you know, whenever I got to see her. So my memories of my childhood are that I was really happy, and I was in a family where everybody, especially my two parents, was really pretty funny. And I was not athletic. I was little. I didn't get to puberty till I was like probably close to 40. So I was like a slow developing. And I wanted to be popular, and I wanted my, you know, kids to like me. And I was really good at this one thing, which was making them laugh and being, you know, and in a subversive way that was, you know, that worked really well, especially when you're in a discipline-intensive environment like school, where there's teachers and rules and stuff like that. I was a kid who was really good at, A, doing well in that environment, you know, but by doing it by kind of undermining everything that was going on in a way that my friends could appreciate and enjoy. So I often get it because you're unhappy. And I know so many comedians who are. You know more than I do. But there's not a lot of happy stand-up comedians. Like,
no, although I'm happy. And
there you go.
You know, I've had...
Well, you're probably a shitty comedian. So
it's true. Yeah. But I guess I had 20 years of adulthood where I was...
Successful.
No, miserable.
Oh.
And so maybe I kind of feel that fueled it a little. My childhood was pretty happy. Although, similar to you, I was... I think it was a... No, not in this book. Maybe two books before. No high school virgin ever says, I want to lose my virginity to the captain of the chess team.
Yeah, so, right. So basically, yeah.
I was captain of the chess team.
Right.
So I related to all those.
I wanted girls to like me, and I wanted guys to like me. And girls weren't going to like me because of how I looked or because I was, you know, a great athlete. And the guys weren't going to like me because I was, you know, good at anything. But I was funny, and people like a funny person. So that was my... incentive to be funny more than any sense of like the world has been wrong to me and I need to get it out somehow, so I'm going to get it out that way. I also felt like I had a good childhood. I had, you know, I felt like I had a good, happy life compared, especially to God, like keep going. I've known some comedians who
yeah.
have terrible lives.
Yeah.
They were funny as hell. And they,
well, classic case is Richard Pryor, you know, grew up in a brothel, didn't know his dad was, and just was, you know, had a horrific life and turned it into humor.
Or Rich, I don't know if you knew Rich Jenny, he was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
You know, just a brilliant comedian, you know, but it turns out desperately unhappy. So I'm glad that's not where I came from. That's not how it happened for me. It happened to me because I really just think because I have funny parents and I learned a skill.
Right. You spend time, you figured, okay, I'm not going to, I kind of feel like the entire basis of the entire growth of civilization is men wanting to attract women.
Yes.
So
yeah.
They build bridges and buildings and,
and I couldn't do those things. I mean, I always say if we have a nuclear war and we revert, you know, humorists are going to be the ones. You know, the guys who are going to survive are the guys out there, you know, right now fixing the sidewalk. The guys, humorous, will be passing through the digestive systems of wolves. You know, we're not going to make it. We don't have that useful skill. But we did later on, you know, when civilization got advanced enough to appreciate humor, that's where we began to shine.
I would actually disagree with that, or else we wouldn't exist. Like, our humorous ancestors.
Wait, you're
going to
claim that humorous built the society?
No, but I'm going to say that... humorists, even in caveman days, just like artists in caveman days, you know, didn't have to be the alpha male to attract women.
You have any proof of all, at all they were humorous?
Yeah, yeah. Darwin had his theory of natural selection, but he also had his little known, this true theory of sexual selection, which says that the artists of a tribe were basically saying, they were so far above the alpha male, they didn't need to do the hunting and stuff like that.
I'm guessing Darwin was kind of a wimpy-looking guy to come up with that theory.
And he married his cousin, which was probably had to, like, second-guess whether he needed to write his theories. You know, should I do this? Like, they're going to think our kids are in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I'm not buying it. I don't think there were a lot of comedians in the caves. I'm just thinking those would be the first guys to get, you know, shoved out.
So I wanted to you know, and again, I keep saying I want to talk about your book, Lessons from Lucy.
Well, you know what? You all have to do is mention it every now and then as you're doing it. We don't ever have to talk about the
no,
book.
No, there are some things you say in there that I really want to talk about. But it strikes me just from reading so much of your stuff through the years that I don't want to say there's a formula to your writing, but it seems like you're either self-deprecating. So you make the self-deprecating point, you make that funny, and then you make an example, which is a huge exaggeration. Like, for instance, you didn't lose your... First, you said, I didn't lose my puberty till late. I was 40. Yeah. You know, so you make the premise, and then there's either a punchline after that, and then there's a further one, which is a huge exaggeration. You do that repeatedly throughout all your books, the exaggeration or the incongruity. Like, this is about as interesting as a hypotenuse. Like, where'd you come up with the word hypotenuse? Like, just this incongruity is like a kind of form of exaggeration. And then the other thing you do is you find you're a great observant of the ridiculous, which I'll put inconvenience under that category. Like the person who's taking 15, you know, spoonfuls of a sample when there's a huge line behind them. So and then you'll point that's the premise. You'll make a joke about it, and the joke might be a sample dialogue you're having with that person. You know, you're very good with those, and then there'll be an exaggeration, like, you know, what if we were...
You're giving away a Nelly. Everybody's going to go out and write humor books now.
No, because I think...
Giving it away. No, I'm kidding.
The thing is, even if that is a formula, which I'm just broadly generalizing, like, there's a lot more to it. But even then, it's hard to find the examples to fill out that formula. That's the hard part. But would you say that's, you know...
Those are two key modes of humor that I use. Another one is what I call the false authority. I loved writing for newspapers because there's no more kind of pompous form of writing than, you know, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, declaring to the world, here's the truth. We know the truth because we're journalists. And of course, I worked in the newspaper business for years, so I've seen how the sausage is made. And, you know, they're not really authorities for the most part, but they write. There's a certain style of writing, and I love to assume the mantle of the authority, and especially when I was writing in a newspaper. This is where I would really get the mail from the angry humor impaired people who cannot process the idea that something written in a newspaper isn't literally true or intended to be true. For years, one of my favorite columns was called "Ask Mr. Language Person," and it was a grammar expert, like William Sapphire is what I patterned it after. And he would, Mr. Language Person, would answer your questions. Of course, I made up the questions and I made up the answers. And every question and every answer was ludicrous. And the answers particularly were possibly wrong. So it'd be like a column filled with grammatical and spelling and every other kind of mistakes. And I would get this mail from teachers that would say, you know, perhaps you didn't notice this, but in this column, and they would have cut the column out and send it back to me, you made an error. And in this forest of, you know, 50, 70, 100 mistakes, they'd have found one and circled it and sent it in to me, you know. But anyway, I loved being authority.
What would you tell? I'm trying to understand. Like, you're not just making fun of people's grammar mistakes. You're writing a grammar column where you're making tons of
mistakes. Everything would be incorrect. Every single thing in it would be wrong. It was a parody of, a guy named William Sapphire, yeah, who wrote a column on language.
Which, by the way, I love that column.
And not only did I love it, I loved that William Sapphire loved Mr. Language Person, and I got to know him. One of the questions to Mr. Language Person was, What exactly does the Lone Ranger say? Does he say "Hi ho, silver away," or I can't remember, or "Hi yo"? Is it "Hi ho, silver" or "Hi yo, silver"? This is the kind of question, mm-hmm, Mr. Language Person would address. And I called up William Sapphire. I'd gotten his number over the years, and he picked it up and said, "Bill Sapphire." I said, "This is Dayberry." He goes, "Yeah." And I goes, "Hi ho, silver" or "Hi yo, silver." He goes, "Hi ho, silver," and he hangs. No, it was actually "Hi yo." God, I can't remember now. Whatever it was, William Sapphire told Mr. Language Person to correct the answer. And then I would write a whole thing about William Sapphire coming in, weighing in on it. But can we necessarily accept his judgment on this question? You know, that was the column.
So the premise of a false authority joke is that you would be largely true. It wouldn't be...
No, you'd be utterly, completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And I was always quoting scientists who didn't exist and organizations that didn't exist. And how can we explain why young people are eating Tide Pods. And, you know, I would quote some psychiatric authorities saying, we just think they're stupid, you know, that kind of authority.
I'm gonna have to play around with that. And then, okay, so we have three things now.
Well, you don't have to use that one because...
No,
I'm having a lot of trouble explaining it to you, I can tell.
No, but it's not that complicated.
They pretend to be authorities, but they're wrong. They are not right. They are wrong, yet they think they're right, or we're pretending they're right.
But you've run for president.
I'm always running for
president. You would say you were a leading candidate for president.
Yeah. I would always
lie. So that's using the false authority.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, also, you could just call it lying, but right. Lying in a newspaper, because that's really the authority is you've got the whole, you know, voice of whatever paper you're in behind you. Everything else they put in there is supposed to help you and make you smarter and teach you more. And here's this one guy coming along trying to make you stupider by lying to you.
Right. Like you're piggybacking on the brand of their truth.
I'm taking on the mantle of authority that newspapers present. And this is getting meta, but you know, newspapers really aren't that authoritative. If you've ever spent any time around journalists, you know, they don't really know very much about anything. They're English majors. So they call up one expert and he tells them something which they only kind of half understand and then write it down. And they maybe call up another expert and that's like their sources. They don't really know what they're talking about half the time, but they're writing the story in the newspaper.
No, it's true. Like I used to work for a bunch of newspapers as well. And once I stopped being in that industry completely, I never read a newspaper again. I don't think I've read a newspaper in about 6 years. And sometimes I'm occasionally called to go on TV to discuss some issue. I don't prepare at all because I know reading the news will not prepare me. But just you know from like people's conversations what's important or not. And then when you're presented, you can give an opinion just as good as anybody else. So that's...
And the fact that you're on television already gives you... Well, you know.
Right.
Michael Crichton wrote, I cannot remember, I'm feeling stupid here. He named this phenomenon. He called it, he said, if you've ever been quoted in a newspaper or had a newspaper story done about you or about something you know very well, you will know immediately that it's full of errors.
Right.
Almost everything is wrong in any story where you really know it. So, and so when you read that, you go, this is ridiculous. This is wrong. He said, and then you turn the page of the newspaper and read what it has to say about the Middle East or the economy, and you believe that.
Right.
The same newspaper. And I'm feeling stupid, and I'm sure people listening will say, it's the blank effect. But Michael Crichton named it. He said, why do we believe what authorities tell us about anything else when we know they're wrong about what they tell us about what we know about?
Sorry, Carlos, you ever read his memoir, Travels?
Oh, Michael Crichton?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, so beautiful.
I love that, the way that guy wrote. He was a genius.
This one memoir... He kind of sucks you in into this concept that he really wants to explore. But first starting off with, you know, I was a medical student, then here's how I got into writing. So you feel like it's a real memoir. And then he sucks you into this amazing journey that he goes on.
Oh, I got to read. Do you remember the name of it?
Travels.
Travels.
Okay. Yeah.
I will get that.
So
I'm going to get it right now while you're talking. I'm just going to download it.
Steve,
No, kidding.
Amazon.
Gelman amnesia effect.
Amnesia effect. That's a great name.
I knew that. I didn't look it up.
Thank you. I knew it was a thing.
Steve was a news producer, so he knows this very well.
No, but I'm kidding. But I do know about not people not being experts, knowing nothing.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I could make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb.
while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
So one thing I noticed, again, and this is more in the you find something ridiculous or slash inconvenient, and then you make fun of it, then you exaggerate to an extreme. There's a certain muscle that notices the ridiculous. I think not everyone notices the ridiculous around them. Like, and just as an example, sometimes I see a stand-up comedian walk onto a stage, and you can see their eyes looking around, and they're quickly like, why are we in the basement of some bar and there's disco balls? Like, what was happening here? You know, they'll kind of find the ridiculous things right away. Or like, sir, why are you wearing your shirt inside out? You know, whatever. And it's a muscle, I think, that takes practice. And you've been writing comedy for 50 years. That's why I say just knowing the formula is not enough. But how would you say, am I speaking too generally? Have you ever thought of it this way? But like, how do you practice this ridiculous muscle?
No, you're absolutely right. I think what a lot of comics do and humor writers do, you observe something that everyone else sees and everyone else already knows. I mean, I always think the heart of humor isn't so much telling people something they never thought of or don't know. It's telling them something they really do know and just haven't kind of paid attention to. But I mean, simple thing like nobody really knows why airplanes can take off. There may be like a couple of guys at Boeing who could actually explain it to you, but most of us, if you were to just not tell us it could happen and go show us an airplane, we would say, what? You're not, but we cheerfully get on them and, just assume that there's somebody up there. Comedians will use that fear that, that you really don't have any idea how this works or if it's going to work this time, just because it worked the other, or what they're really doing up there in the front of the airplane. They're probably going, oh, Jesus. And then, so yeah, it's a simple observational skill.
But you're right. Like everybody, when you say that, it's like, okay, yeah, you're right. But I never thought that before that I don't even know how a plane works.
Right.
Like the Wright brothers know, and that's it.
But we're not afraid, for the most part, of getting on planes because everyone else pretends to, yeah, sure. This gigantic heavy thing, which they've just loaded all this crap onto, and us, and food for us. Sure, it's just going to roll down there and fly. I think because we all trust that everyone else agrees that it's going to happen, we shouldn't worry about it. And the comic comes along and says, "Why in the world do we think this is going to work? Why is what are we thinking?" That's kind of probing that fear is a major source of humor. Not necessarily, I'm not doing a great job with the airplane because I haven't thought about it that much, but I would.
I'll give you an example. Louis C.K. sort of makes a joke about the plane concept, about the awesomeness of flying. Like, and so he's making someone.
I've heard that, and it's really wonderful. And he's right. Like, wait, what people are upset because their flight was like a half an hour late. You just got in this tube and went from New York to LA in 6 hours?
Like a Greek god. Like you were in a chair that flew through space.
Your phone doesn't get, away, doesn't get the picture you're waiting for. Well, it has to go to space.
Would you give it a minute?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just observing something that everyone is taking for granted.
But that's hard, though. How do you practice observing that? Because, again, like, we're used to, as Seinfeld even talks about this, he says, everyone goes into a room and looks for what's right, whereas the comedian or a humorist goes into a room and looks for what's wrong.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of really practice that over and over again, looking for what's wrong, because you want to see only what's right.
Yes. I mean, I don't even add anything to that, because that is exactly what comedians are doing. They're constantly finding. Everybody wants the world to be rational. Everybody wants there to be an explanation for things.
And yet it's so irrational.
And it's completely irrational.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. And you're going to die at the end of it. And meanwhile, a lot of your friends are going to die. And some of them are going to die in horrible ways. All of these things are horrible. All of them. And we're in this world where all these horrible things are happening, not just occasionally. They're happening all the time. And you will die for sure at the end. So what do? We have two reactions to that. One of them is religion. It's really okay because God wants it to be this
right,
way.
And God fills in all the holes.
Something bad is happening because God has a reason for that. Don't worry. And you don't really die. You really don't die. And you're going to see your mom again, everything. That's one reaction, religion. And the other is humor, which is for some weird reason, no other animal does this. We evolved this ability to go, oh, that's funny. It's not really funny. It's terrifying, that when you think about it, that you're going to die or that the plane might not take off. But we have this comfortable, we have this way of psychically dealing with it so we don't go completely insane. Animals deal with it by not thinking about it.
Right.
It never occurs to a dog or a coyote that anything would be any different.
Right.
They know it's hard out there. They know they better eat the food right now. The other coyote's going to get it. They know they better run from that animal because it'll kill them. They just don't worry about it because that's the way it is. We worry about it. Think about it. Why is it that way? Why shouldn't it be another way? Is it really fair?
And then I guess when you're thinking about fairness or irrational stuff, trying to convert that into humor becomes a source of a lot of what you write. But what you just said about animals segues perfectly into Lessons from Lucy, your most recent book. Page Turner.
For sale in bookstores.
For sale in bookstores as of like yesterday.
Yeah.
So I had an advanced copy, but I also bought my, I also got my bought copy from Amazon yesterday.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I always feel authors should get paid. So I never just get the advanced
also,
copy.
Also, you gave me, can I tell the our audience what you gave me?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, this is
the only one. Gave you a gift before the podcast.
A 250 dinar?
Yeah.
Dinar note from Iraq. With a picture of Saddam Hussein on it.
No longer in circulation in Iraq, I might add.
This is like the cheesiest. I'm surprised even when it was freshly printed, anybody ever took it. It's this cheesiest looking money I've ever seen, but I'm so grateful.
I have an idea. Let me just tell you this idea. I want to go to every like coffee deli or whatever, order coffee, and then they charge me, you know, $1.50. And I reach my pockets. I'm like, oh, shit.
All I've got is these dinars.
I don't have any. I forgot to bring my cash. Can you take this dinar, and I want to see how many people will we get paid in Saddam Hussein currency.
That would be a good idea. The answer probably is zero because people just, you know, they're kind of serious. But that if you had a really funny person, they would say yes, because actually it's probably worth more than a cup of coffee, don't you think?
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah. But okay, the stuff about animals does segue into your Lessons from Lucy. You kind of you know, at 70, you want to make sure you enjoy the rest of your dwindling life. And you basically learn from Lucy's ability to essentially live in the moment and all the benefits that come from a dog just being happy and lovable and living in the moment. You translate that into human ease. And of course, then it's not about dogs, but it's all the things in your life and all the humorous things you notice. But the first lesson really resonated with me, which is that you wanted to have more friends. And I think about this to the point where I ask my therapist about this. Like, as a kid, of course, we have friends. And when, you know, you have friends that even knock on your door and say, hey, how's it going? Well, let's go out.
And you just hang out.
Yeah.
You, like, have sleepovers.
Right.
I mean, like, it almost seems weird, but why does it become strange? When I was a kid, the most fun thing I could do is, like, Neil Thompson, who is my best friend, lived down the street. Hey, can Neil sleep over tonight? Yeah, yeah. And we were so excited about it, even though we saw each other all the time, all day, every day. It was just like an exciting thing to do. And then at some point, we just totally lose that joy in another person's, you know,
and
companionship.
And yet, friendship and connection are keys to, or are correlated with longevity. Like, maybe I'm being a false authority.
My wife will live to be 700 years old if that's true, because she is like, she makes more friends in a day than I have in my, you know, my entire life. She's so friendly.
And like friends to the, I sort of feel like friends to the point where she can just call up anytime and say, hey, how's it going?
That's what they do.
Yeah.
That's what, I mean, I do generalize about this, men versus women, but my wife can, you know, have not seen somebody for an hour and they'll see each other and then they will recount that hour, and it takes them longer than dental school to go over just, you know, what and I can't do that. If I see somebody I haven't seen in 25 years, I can be caught up in 30 seconds.
You know, yeah. Like,
so you're not dead, and how are your kids? You know, and yeah, they're good. Good. The kids are good. My wife would never settle for the kids are good. You know, that each kid would be a long, detailed discussion with many side roads before we got back to the main key. And then the next kid and the next kid. And I can't do that. I don't do that.
And so how many friends?
Four. I have four friends.
You have four friends. Is that really true?
That I know of that are alive, yeah.
And so by that.
No, I probably more than that. But I literally have four guys I consider really close friends.
That you can call up and say anything.
But I don't. I don't call them. And then one of them. There's one guy I call and he calls me. And I only call him because he calls me. I feel guilty that I should call him too.
And they're friends outside of anything you do?
Yeah, like yeah. They're just friends.
It's not like most Stephen of them King, like, back. Hey, how's it going?
Oh, well, Steve, yeah. He's like, I mean, he's always calling me, but I don't answer. Yeah. No, I do consider him a friend, but close friends, really close friends, I only have a few.
And how many do you think one should have? Like, you say you want more.
I don't know. I don't know if there's a good answer for that, but I do think I should have more. I think I should do more things with guys than I do, you know, like.
But do you ever like I had a situation where.
You can't be friends with women though. I've learned that because it's a problem because your wife doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Your wife doesn't like it when I have friends with women. No. No, I mean my wife.
That was funny. Yeah. Wordplay.
Yeah,
a fourth technique.
Hey, just tossing it out there. Add that to your list of things.
Wordplay.
Misdirection.
Yeah.
No, I can't remember. Oh, yeah. It is hard to have friends with women and it just be friends. Everybody just knows about this issue, I think. I'm limiting it to guys, but I wish I had more guy friends that, but part of the problem is I don't want them.
You know? Right. Well, that's just,
I just want to be alone, you know?
I was about to ask, like I had a situation recently where someone I thought, oh, maybe I could be friends with this person. He and his wife said, hey, can you and your wife go out to dinner? And like, I suddenly realized like with every fiber in my body, I did not want to go to dinner. I did not want to leave my apartment like have conversation.
No, it's too much work. I could watch Netflix if I stay. Right. Oh no, it's really overpowering and it gets worse and worse and worse. And then, you know, I cast my mind back to, you know, just even like, well, high school, college, I knew a lot of guys. We did a lot of stuff.
So maybe good friends are not necessary, but maybe just
guys,
a lot of acquaintances.
You hang out with.
Well, but do you hang out? Do you like say, oh, honey, poker night, I'm going out. Like, I don't even do that.
No, I would never get away.
Or she would have to
I
go.
I would never get away with that. I don't even know how to play poker. The first thing you'd say, what's a flush? And I go, I don't know. It's, you know, I would make a toilet joke. And so it's hard. But it's a big issue for me. And it's like, I think a lot of older guys, I think it's an older guy issue. Where you kind of become more isolated, and I actually talk in the book about it. I do some group activity things. I'm in a rock band, which kind of we're bad, but we get together.
But you haven't played since 2015.
Well, we're playing in May.
Okay, where?
And we're playing in Minneapolis in May. But I'll drop the name. Stephen King. Well, we already dropped that name. He's in the band, and so is Ridley Pearson, and so is Greg Isles, and a bunch of other people. Mitch Albom, Scott Turow,
Amy Tan.
But so we're playing in May, and it's kind of my idea, and it was partly because of this book. It's like I'm going to do fun things with people,
which is another lesson. Don't stop having fun. Lesson.
Yeah, there you go. And like dogs don't. Like dogs never think it's too. They never get too old to run after the ball. You know, that's fun. They're going to keep doing it. It's not like I can't do that anymore. Well, I'm not run after the ball, but you think like you're too old to do things that you actually enjoy, but they just don't seem age appropriate anymore. Well, this is my example. I'm in this band and we're going to play in May, but Steven hasn't played with us for a while. And so he wanted us to practice, which is not really our style. We're not the kind of band that practices ahead of time.
Right, and you didn't drop this name, but Bruce Springsteen advised you not to get any better.
Exactly. Bruce Springsteen played with us once, and his exact words were, don't get any better, because then you'll just be another shitty band.
Yeah.
But we still play. So anyway, we don't really practice. We play, and then we say, we should have practiced. That's kind of our style. And but Steven hasn't played with us in a long time, so he wanted to at least know what songs are we going to do and what are the chords. I'm not saying he can play the chords. I'm saying he wants to know them, all right? So we met in January at his house, me, Ridley, Greg Isles, and Stephen King, and we practiced for 2 days in Stephen King's garage, and it was great.
Fun.
And at night, we went out to dinner, and then we went back and practiced some more, and we're terrible, and it was just four guys in a garage, and he has a really nice garage.
So what advice would you give to listeners or to even to me, like, I like sitting at home watching TV. I like playing chess, which I could do online at home. I like coming here, but it's not. Sometimes you don't meet friends among other, you know, comedians are very anxious about their comedy, and then they go off and do other things.
And they always want to know how they did.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a little competitive sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, a little. So, it's a little competitive between comedians. Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah,
so I'm just being fair to the. I own the club, so I can't be mean to anybody. But. What advice would you give? Like how would you find that compass that directs you to having more friends?
I don't have like really specific do this. I just think if you need to be aware, especially as you age, that you're going to change in a bad way. You're going to get less social. You're going to get more cranky. You're going to get less willing to explore, less imaginative, less just, less spontaneous. And you need to think about that, be aware of it, to combat it. You know, and if something comes up, like you had an opportunity to go out, I might not like them. It's like it's cold out, whatever. Maybe you should think, go anyway. And, you know.
And it was the worst dinner ever. Never doing that again. Oh, my God.
So the lesson there is never go out.
No, but I do want to
go out with those people.
I do like people and want to be friends. And then you get into this, that kind of gray area where you don't know what to do.
Well, my daughter played soccer for 14 years, from age 4 to age 18. She played soccer, girls soccer. And it became really a great, important part of my life, partly because I love watching her play soccer. You know, it's my daughter and everything. But also, like, when you play soccer, like, you're with other parents. You got to go to the field, you know, you got to drive to some horrendous town in Central Florida and sit in the rain during rain delay. You know, you got to go to the hotel bar afterwards and you spend a lot of time around people you would never know if it weren't for the fact that your daughter and their daughter are on the same team. And it was the kind of thing where I would, if it weren't for Sophie, I would never know these people. I would not hang around with these people.
Did you become friends with them?
I became really good friends, not with all of them, but I had many great experiences. I became friends. I miss them because she went away to college, and now I don't do that anymore. And I need to find another thing like that where for some random reason I'm with random people. And you know, when you get older and more successful as you have, you can choose everything about your life, where you live, who you spend time with. You know, you don't need to meet anybody. You can control that completely. In a way, you can't when you're a kid. You got to go to high school with the other high school kids. You don't get to pick who's in your class. You go to college, you don't get to pick who's your classmates are.
So my takeaway is I should figure out.
You should have a daughter who plays soccer.
I have a daughter who does ballet.
That's the same thing, only it's, oh, God.
Yeah, that's the worst experience ever.
Because my daughter at the beginning was doing dance and soccer.
Ugh.
And I was still like rooting for soccer over dance.
You sit 3 hours to watch five seconds.
And they do two performances. One's, you know, at about the hour mark and one's about the 2 hour and 50 minute mark. And you can't even tell which one is your daughter half the time out there with all the makeup on.
What I do is I sit right outside the performance area so I could just read a book. And
you didn't go in to watch the show?
I'm not watching a bunch of 7 year olds.
Oh, you mean when it was your daughter's
turn? Yeah. And then I would count I knew when she was on the schedule. So I would just count whenever there was the silence and applause. And then when it was when her turn was up, meaning my turn, I would go in.
I never thought of that. Yeah. I sat and watched everybody else's kids dance badly just so I could watch my own daughter dance badly.
Now, but there's so many other good lessons. Just real quickly, you know, it's all obvious stuff. Try not to judge people by their looks.
In this book people don't already know. It's just,
but it's hard to like let go of
your
anger.
People don't do these things.
Yeah, let go of your anger. As we discussed, there's people on Facebook, for instance, are so angry at each other all the time. One time I posted a photo of myself with President Clinton, and regardless of my politics, like, okay, it's neat to have a photo with a guy who was a former president. I would do President Nixon. I would do
How about Hitler?
That I probably would not do.
All right. Well, he was never president. Just a little.
I wish
little information
I could do it, but I. but immediately I got 100. Like people would write, like, okay, deleted, and. Like, you get so, like, crazy.
No, and it's getting worse and worse and worse in this
country. Yeah, it's only going to get worse.
Right? I will not talk about politics with anybody anymore.
Yeah,
because I don't need to watch people get angry.
Well, you make a good point. You know, do it if you're going to do it. Like, here's some rational facts. I'm happy to discuss it rationally.
You cannot do that anymore. You have to take a side right away. And you're a good person or a bad person. That's, you know, it doesn't matter what your rational facts are. Which side are you on? And that's all that matters to anybody anymore. And I'm tired of it.
Right,
I'm just tired of watching people call each other names.
But I do want to get to the you know, I was finishing this book and I was thinking, man, good book. And, you know, then you have the epilogue. I read the epilogue, which kind of sums things up. And I'm not into dogs, but you make the whole analogy with the dogs. And again, it's hardly anything really about dogs. You just make the analogy about your dog, Lucy, and all these lessons and things you need to do. And all the funny anecdotes and experiences. And then you have this terrifying and sad and horrific, and as a father of 4 daughters now and another kid, story about your daughter who you have one last lesson at the very end of the book. I think I'm done. I'm about to put it down. I'll read this last lesson tomorrow. And then I start reading it and like, oh my God, is this, what is happening? And I don't even know if you want to go into it or if you want
to. No, sure. I can talk about it.
So first off, I'll just quickly explain. Your daughter wakes up mostly paralyzed or paralyzed from the waist down. I say mostly paralyzed. And she's leaving. She's supposed to be leaving for Duke in two days. You take her to the hospital thinking it's just like a panic attack. You realize, no, this is much more serious. She has some disease that you call
transverse myelitis.
Which the word transverse sounds funny. I'm almost thinking that's a joke, but you mentioned it enough.
It was a real joke. It's not a real joke.
No, you say this is like the worst moments of your life. And considering we talked about some of the other horrific things that happened in your life earlier, and obviously with a kid, it's the terrifying, it's scary. And you really express that. It's really moving. The feelings for your daughter, your fear at that moment, the advice you have for people who are well-wishing, but it's just, they don't even realize it comes off wrong. And so I just want to ask also, how is Sophie, your daughter, doing now? Because you finish before she's fully recovered.
She's recovered and you know, with a few minor concerns, but she's at Duke and she's a happy college student, which is all she wanted to be. So if you saw her, you would never know anything happened. You'd see a beautiful girl walking around Duke.
Does she feel any pain walking around? Is there any? Could she do soccer?
I don't know. You know, she hasn't. She's still in physical recovery, and so she's taking, you know, doing some therapy and stuff. But she's physically fine.
But part of the physical recovery is simply because she was off her feet for so long.
She was unable to walk.
So her muscles must have atrophied.
Yes,
and now she's
and there's a
from
lot
that.
Of yeah, a lot and a lot of relearning. As a result of this disease, she had to relearn how to do a lot of things.
And the doctor told you the prognosis was third. So third.
Well, that was the internet told. The doctor wouldn't tell us anything.
Oh, the doctor didn't tell you anything.
Well, they're with this particular disorder. They don't promise you a thing. Neurologists are very careful about what they say because they don't want to get sued for the most part. But the outcome is there's no guarantees, and it often does not work out well.
But is it the fact that she was young and athletic, does that help?
That helped a lot. It's not
so that move from a third to 60%?
That's what we told ourselves. That's what we told Sophie, and that's what, you know, she did recover.
And she had a positive outlook.
She's unbelievable. She's the strongest, bravest person I've ever known. I mean, I know she's my daughter, but imagine you're 18, you're about to go to college and you can't walk, you're in a wheelchair and nobody's telling you ever will walk again. All your friends come to say goodbye, Sophie, and then they're off. They're gone to college, and you're seeing, you know, she's on Instagram, she's on, you know, all those, whatever they're on, and she sees all her friends, you know, first day of school, meeting her roommates, going there, and she's in an ICU with tubes in her and getting transfusions, and doctors are, you know, saying, we don't know. So
it's got to be scary.
She never stopped, you know, being positive. She never stopped thanking every doctor who came in. Even if every nurse gave her a shot, she still thanked them. And she never stopped smiling, and she's kept her sense of humor. The middle of the night, like, I mean, when it was dark times for us, I was crying. When I wasn't with Sophie, I was crying. And Michelle never left Sophie, so she was like holding it all in. For 40 days, she slept on a hospital bed. But Sophie, in the middle of the night one night, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, says to her mom, you know, she's lying there with all these tubes beeping, and she says, you know, mom, this would be a really good college essay. Because, you know, like when they're writing their essays, right. When she wrote her essay, she's like, they ask you, what's your biggest challenge? She said, what? I've had a good life. I don't have any challenges. And here, you know, she had a big challenge. But anyway, that's what happened. She's good now.
But still is a beautifully written chapter, and you have some humor in it, but it's also very moving. And there's a lesson, which is if you wake up and the sun's out and you're walking, be grateful. And we always tell ourselves that, but we always forget it.
Exactly. I will never forget it now. I mean, if there's any positive to come out of this, I never will forget what we lost, what we thought we lost. When we thought, you know, because you're a parent, you know, you think your kid's never going to walk again. You're never going to be happy again. And you know it. You know your life is over as you knew it. It's going to be a different life. And if you had asked me when this was going on, what would you be grateful about? I would say nothing. But then when you're through it, you like I said, you realize what matters in your life, and it's not most of the stuff you think about most of the time. it's, you know, if you're healthy and your kids are healthy, you should be very grateful. I don't care what your other living condition, but if you get up in the morning, if you're reasonably healthy and your kids are reasonably healthy, you have more than a lot of people and you should be grateful every day for it. And if you think other things are more important than that, you're wrong. And if you, the quick way to find out is to have something happen like what happened to us. And you know, then.
Well, thank God that worked out.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Again, Dave, Barry, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Lessons from Lucy. I'll say it again. I think I laughed out loud at this book. And the last book I laughed out loud for was Best State Ever, your book about Florida. Yeah. And the last book before that, now I've forgotten the title, but...
Moby Dick.
It was the green and blue one. I forget the title.
I've written a lot of books.
But... Yes, 50 books. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
This was great. I really enjoyed it. I'm not kidding. This was really one of the more
fun
interviews.
Well, when you're back in New York ever,
I'd love
come
to.
Come on, or if we go down to Miami, can you come on the podcast again?
Absolutely. I'd love
Excellent.
To.
Excellent.
Well, we've now run out of everything we could possibly talk about, but we talk about Florida, won't
we? There's 1,000 more questions I have about humor, and you're the expert in the world, so thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.